Hello, everyone, and welcome into Debate Night. We're back. It feels like we've been gone for a long time, but we did an episode, 2 weeks ago? It just was...
Is that how long ago it was?
Well, we missed last week. 2 weeks ago, we weren't live because we were in Charleston and the internet sucked. And so we did the post-produced one in Charleston. Mm-hmm. So it's been 3 weeks, I think, since we've been live. I get to go back 3 weeks. So it feels like we've been gone for an eternity.
It's good to be back.
And we got a lot to catch up on here. First thing I want to bring up as people roll in here, this show I feel like has changed since when we initially launched it, right?
Well, yeah, no one calls in to debate.
So do we change the name from Debate Night?
Sure, let's do it.
I don't know. I don't have any name suggestions. Maybe we'll put a poll out or something, but I just feel like we're calling it Debate Night and then we don't debate because we agree on most things and we can't really do call-ins, and when we do call-ins, it's the Q&A show.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously set up more for, you know, the haters that were saying stuff. The problem is the haters have gone quiet. I mean, it makes sense. I'm not really saying ridiculous things on Twitter anymore. And honestly, a lot of stuff that I previously said on Twitter has either come true and like is happening now, or other people that are more established and been around the sport more have now said it as well. And I'm still playing disc golf. I think that was a shock to a lot of people. A lot of people thought I was jumping into disc golf for a year or two and then bouncing. And then obviously a lot of people thought that I wasn't going to make really any noise in the sense of like finishes or being in tournaments or whatnot. So yeah, the silence is deafening. Is that the phrase?
That's the phrase. Silence is deafening.
Yeah. So I think people are tuning in more. I mean, obviously we'll sometimes go off and have differing opinions on some things, but for the most part we pretty much say the same thing or agree on a lot of stuff. So me and you probably aren't the best people to have on. We're not a Skip Bayless and Stephen A. Smith where they are, you know, having pre-meetings. Like I literally just got off the course, drove here, and this is the first time I've been talking to you, basically. So like we don't have like a pre-meeting of like what we're gonna talk about.
No.
Hey, you say this, I'll say this, you come at, you know, and so we don't really have this like setup of where, you know, we definitely have like I have a list of like 7 or 8 things I want to talk about tonight, but I don't know if you're gonna agree with me or you're gonna disagree with me. So the shows don't really work that well if we do Debate Night and then we agree on everything. So exactly. I agree with you on that. And it is a different show than Grip Lock.
Much
because,
different.
Because Grip Lock, you guys are talking a lot more results, those type of storylines. And then also, I feel like I bring being on the course, playing in the tournaments and stuff. We talk about some things that, you know, might not be brought up on Grip Lock. So the two shows are completely different, but I agree with you. I don't think this is much of a debate show anymore, like we thought it was.
Yeah, that's what we thought. That's what it started as, or intended to be, but I think it just
my biggest Twitter hater now just called me a what do you call me? What's the McDonald's thing? Whopper? No, that's
Big Mac?
Burger King. Yeah, he's called me a Big Mac. So he's like, he's running out of material. He's got nothing.
I mean, that's almost a compliment. I'd love to be a Big Mac.
Yeah, he basically said I'm the Big Mac of McDonald's. So whatever that means, sure.
Probably the most popular ordered item of all time.
I don't think so. I think the double quarter pounder and cheese is way more popular. But I might just have a bias.
Big Mac?
It.
I mean,
that's like ordering a Whopper at Burger King.
Yeah, like that's the thing.
That's
the go-to.
You know, Mac sauce. That's their signature, man.
Sauce. There's a chance that I've never actually ordered a Big Mac.
No, I never.
I've had.
What?
Yeah.
You just defended it.
The greatest.
It is the most hype thing.
The first time I ever had a Big Mac was in the Beijing airport at like. 2 a.m. We landed. Everyone was looking for Chinese food. And I was like, I want something. And I went to McDonald's. And I was like, you know what? Now's the time. And I ordered a Big Mac. And it was incredible. I used to just get a plain double cheeseburger with mac sauce.
Isn't that pretty much the same thing?
There's another bun in between on a Big Mac.
The McDonald's in Finland, way better food, but it took twice as long, which I'm okay with.
Did they have like different stuff? Way better. Different stuff on the menu?
No, it was very, very similar menu. They did have like apple slices, carrot sticks, mozzarella sticks. They had like a few items that were in. They had a chicken wrap, which is very common. But then they had like three other different wraps I've never seen before. They called, I don't know if they called mayonnaise McFeast sauce or something. McFeasty or something. There were some interesting things on there, but it was actually not too bad. But yeah, I think we are in for a name change for sure, because I do think obviously initially people were like, you guys don't debate. There's no debates. Where are the debates? And when we do take calls, it's questions. Like, people are just asking questions. No one's coming in saying, hey, Brody, you said this. You're an idiot. This is what is actually going on. So I like it. Let's change it up. Let's find a good podcast name, yeah. And we'll do a little rebrand.
If you got some suggestions, feel free to put them in the chat or throw them at us over on Twitter. And next week, we might be back.
Oh, someone said. Oh, go ahead.
No, you go first.
I got food in his mouth. He just took a massive.
Well, he said, oh, like, yeah, hold on.
Hold on.
Someone said, call it On the Fairway with Brody Smith. I feel like that's pretty good.
Okay, Hunter.
We'll get there. We're starting.
Hunter's name just gets left out.
Bro date night
Date night. We could go like the Dave Portnoy show with Eddie and crew. It could be like the Brody Smith show with Hunter and crew. So then Silas is crew.
I'm just crew.
I'm thrown in there. Or it could just be Cy Guy or Silas and the guys. Big Cy and the guys. Is that what Connor said? Big Cy and the guys.
So, yeah.
Just make it Silas's show and we're just here.
I've completely forgot my whole idea of what I was going to say. What were you talking about before you said that, Silas?
McDonald's?
Yeah, McDonald's.
Finland. No, there's something else. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It might come to me. It might not. That's what I was going to say.
He's back.
Leave your suggestions not in the live chat, because leaving it in the live chat, comments, it's going to be gone. Leave it like if you're watching right now live on YouTube, or if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or something like that, go to YouTube and leave it in the comment section on the actual YouTube video.
Great point. Great point. Yeah, in the live chat, it's going to be as good as gone.
Okay. Do you want to start? Oh, you had something?
I have an ad read.
Oh, real quick. Okay. Go for it.
Before I get too far into today's show, I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor of today's show, Double G Jerky. Making craft beef jerky was a household staple in Double G's family, and he became fascinated with creating his own flavors as a teenager. He continued his interest in jerky preparation throughout his professional years and now operates his own brand of craft jerky, aptly named Double G Craft Jerky. They start by hand-selecting the highest quality meats and placing an emphasis on the most savory seasoning and nutritionally focused ingredients. Double G produces the best-tasting and highest quality jerky on the market. When you order their craft beef jerky online, you'll be amazed at the freshness and the quality and the flavors that you'll experience. With the disc golf season in full swing and everyone also about to hit the trails and slopes this winter, you'll want to stock up on these so you always have them handy when you need a boost. Head over to doublegjerky.com and pick some up today. They also just came out with the vegan beef jerky. I haven't had a chance to try it yet.
That's Eagles, right?
Yeah.
I wonder if he was eating that during his championship run.
I mean, it's tough to say that that's not what got him there. I don't know.
I will you know, do a little tip of the cap to Double G by saying that his business might be the number one disc golf business, because we've seen pros and stuff come out with a lot of stuff and they kind of fades out and fizzles out. The stuff that they've been able to do over there is actually very impressive. So I don't know if they're in like stores yet. I don't know about that. Like if they're doing wholesale to like retailers and stuff, but impressive stuff. So tip of the cap to Double G.
If you're interested in learning more about the flavors, if you go back Bogey Bro Banter 2 weeks ago now, possibly three. Trevor and Connor did a full breakdown. They tasted all the flavors and all of that. And I believe their favorite was teriyaki. Do you remember, Silas? Or was it the hot one?
Was it that boom sauce?
Oh, yeah. Boom it was sauce? Boom sauce. It was hot the hot one. Sauce? Hot boom sauce. But there you go. All right. Well, Brody, I don't know if you want to lead this off, but I want to hear this USDGC qualification story. He might be frozen. We might have lost him.
Yeah, it's a good story.
So, it's a great story. Well, while he might, he's probably going to have to switch to his phone.
Is he back?
Is he back? He's definitely not back. I'll text him. I don't think he knows he's gone.
Oh, he's
no,
back.
I know
he's
I'm
back.
Gone.
Okay.
No, you're back.
Okay, you're back.
You're here.
I'd switch to the phone. I'd switch to the phone to be safe.
Yeah, I mean, what? We're 2 minutes in and the internet already is trash? Yeah. What is this, man?
I'd switch to the phone to be safe. I'll give him a quick rundown. I don't know the story. I'll just give him the context while you switch to the phone. So essentially, not every tournament, but USDGC qualifiers happen at a lot of big tournaments. DDO, where Brody came in third, for some reason wasn't a USDGC qualifier. European Open, he was able to tie for fourth, which usually means you have to go to a playoff to earn the qualification spot. I'm assuming that's what happened. I haven't heard the story, so I'm going to hear the story live with you all now. It seems like Brody's... Switch to the
off
phone.
The top? We want to just give the best story off the top. I have so many other things I want to talk about.
If you want to talk about other stuff first, that's fine. I'm just dying to hear it because I haven't heard it yet.
Well, yeah, but aren't you supposed to, like, isn't that the whole thing with podcasts? Is like you want to
keep them in?
Story?
That's fine. All right, let's build up to the best. What do you want to start with then?
Or not? Like, I don't know.
I don't know.
I just felt like that's, now I got to do this light. That looks terrible, Silas. No? How's that?
You look great, man. You're killing it. It's perfect.
That's all right.
All right. Well, you know, I'm doing what I can. I don't know. They got me on. I'm on the edge of this building, so I'm guessing the Wi-Fi is not great all the way down this hallway. I have no idea. It was good for a second, but we can talk about it. I don't want people to get pissed off and be like, "What the heck? There's dragging me out." I want to hear about it. So, But I do want to talk more about the tournament stuff.
Absolutely.
I got like things on here. Okay. So first things first, I kind of just want to talk about like how I even got to that point. So obviously had first round, second round, had like, I would say an okay round both times. I made a lot of like really bad mistakes. We can kind of go more into like how the course is set up because I don't think it really, maybe they did do a good job of explaining it on coverage, but there are some things that I feel like are harder to see on coverage than in person. So I want to explain a little bit of that on some of these holes. But yeah, first two rounds, I would say were like sixes. The one round that I shot six under, that one was, I felt like I was really close from that to being like a 9 or 10 under round. And that would have been awesome. But the weekend comes and just didn't have it. Just literally really frustrating how I was playing. Just could not score. And so my mindset going into Sunday basically changed, right? Because even after my first two rounds, even though I was, you know, at that point, I was probably like 10 shots back, I think, of Eagle and Paul, I'm still thinking that I have a chance of winning. Right. If I go out and have an incredible weekend and they slip up, who knows what can happen. Right. After round three, things are obviously, you know, played out a little bit. And it's clear that now a top 10 is essentially what I'm after. And that was kind of my goal going into the final round was a top 10. Now, started off super slow, which was the theme of my entire tournament. Hole one is a birdie hole, didn't birdie it a single time. Hole two, birdie hole, didn't birdie it a single time. Did throw it into the circle once, but missed my 25 footer for birdie. Threw OB once, made bogey, threw it over into the trees, threw it to like 25 feet, missed that putt for, so I played that hole two over. So I was two over par on the first two holes, which is really bad. I would look, if you looked at the top 10 guys, I'm guessing they averaged probably 5 under par on those first two holes, and I was 2 over. Hole 3, which is a birdie hole, I eagled it 1 round, which is awesome. But hole 3 is also a birdie hole, and I ended up parring it after throwing OB. And so now I'm even par through 3. Not a good start. I can continue to kind of just like flutter along. And my whole thing, I had an incredible caddy, by the way, Timmy, absolute beast. Our whole strategy was like, we're not going to look at the scoreboard at all, because our play style doesn't change until hole 15. We are going aggressive mode on every hole, trying to birdie every hole. And then once we get to hole 15, 16, 17, and even 18, all are holes that you can actually play differently, right? You mm-hmm. can play aggressive for birdie, or you can play smart for par. So we get to hole 15, and I already am like, at that point in time, I don't even know how, I'm like, I don't know, 1 under par, 2 under par, something like that. I'm like, I know I've dropped so far off this leaderboard, but I look at it and I'm like, I mean, I think I'm like 20-something, 25th or 7th at this point. So now I'm like, all right, top 10, I can't get a top 10. It's not possible. So now I go down the next thing on the list. The next thing on the list was a USDGC spot. So I start looking at that. Number 1 and number 2 are guys that are, I think, at this point, I'm on 15, they're like on 12. They're both like 17 or 16 under par. So they look like, unless they have an absolute collapse, those two spots are locked in. Canute in the clubhouse at like 15 under or something like that, and he's locked in. There's no way, unless I like, you know, birdie out and eagle two holes, there's no way I'm catching him. So he's locked in. Go down. Number 4 is the guy on my card, Daniel. Is his last name Davidson? I think it's Daniel. I can't remember what his last name is. But he's on my card. And at this point in time, he's 3 shots ahead of me. He's 2 shots ahead of me going into hole 15. So I'm like, all right, we got to go for it. And if you you to kind of refresh your memory, hole 15 is that, you know, the one that was like $10,000 to ace, like 550 feet downhill. And I went for it all 3 days. Was inbound one time, threw a scuba, miss, tap in, par. Went OB left one time, threw a scuba, miss, tap in, bogey. And then one time the wind was just right to left. So I went the big hyzer out over everything and threw it to like 15 feet and then missed the putt. So the hole was not doing great for me. So I went for it I'll say this in a jokingly manner. The disc that has been flipping all week just didn't flip. But really, I threw a bad shot and it went OB. And threw a scuba, missed it, bogeyed. So now I'm down 3 with hole 16, 17, 18 left for a USDGC spot. Hole 16, throw a good tee shot, throw it up there, birdie. He misses his approach shot. So now he gets his next shot up there, taps in par. Now I'm down 2. Threw a really great shot on 17, just maybe 10 feet too high. So it didn't get to the ground fast enough and just barely got out of bounds, but I'm pin high. And when you're pin high left OB on that hole, you've got like a 20 footer for par. He went OB early, so he has like a 55 footer for par. He ends up just missing, tapping in for his bogey. So now I'm down 1 on 18. 18, throw a great shot in the spot that I was basically hitting all week. He throws a good shot. We're both in the fairway. I'm further down the fairway, but I'm more I'm further away from the basket with how that hole's set up, right? Which is actually exactly where I wanted to be, because I wanted to be able to throw first to put pressure on him.
Yeah.
To make have to make a throw.
Was he aware that he'd like, was he aware of the situation? Okay.
I think he was probably aware starting hole 16.
Gotcha.
I want to say is when he kind of knew that we were battling for the spot.
Yeah.
So I threw my second shot up there. And it's really hard to tell exactly how close it is, but if you get that skip left of the, of like the podium
the stage, spot, yeah, yeah.
Stage, if you get that skip left and you get the green flag, you know, you're like within 25 feet. So that's what my shot did. So now he knows if I birdie this hole, I have the USDGC locked. If I par this hole, we're going into playoff. And if I bogey it, I potentially could lose it. So it was going to be really interesting. I was really curious to see how he was going to play it because that hole is really easy to bogey if you go early OB left. Because yeah. Then you're left with like a 50-footer on an elevated basket. He goes right at it and just kind of juices it. Not sure if the adrenaline was kind of kicking up or whatever. But from my vantage point, I thought it was over. I was like, oh, he's just 20 feet on the backside. It's over. He's going to make it. We walk up there. Timmy's like telling me this whole time, like, it might not be over. It might not be over. I'm like, dude, he's not going to miss this putt. It's over. It's over. We get up there. We see a little bit of his teal disc and it's under the tree. Mm. And I'm like, whoa, okay. It's a 20 footer, but now he's got like a tree in his, it's not just a pure basic 20 footer.
Yeah.
So he gets up there. He's got, he's like straddling out, you know, kind of almost on a knee and gives it a good effort, goes off the cage. I step up to my 25 footer, which I was, or 20 footer, whatever it was, which I was extremely nervous. And thank goodness it found the chains and went in. And now at this point, we're both tied for fourth. And we're like, all right, well, what the heck? I knew that we couldn't start the playoff right away because there was that chance of one of those two guys really, you know, 16, you can take a 10.
Yeah.
It's not hard.
Yeah.
And that's, we're going to talk about 16 here in a second, but I knew that, I mean, heck, someone could, you know, God forbid, injure themselves, DNF. There's a lot of things that could happen.
Yeah.
To where it's like, we have to kind of wait. And so we ended up waiting, I think, until like hole 18. And they told us that the playoff holes for us were going to be 1, 2, and 3.
Okay. Your nemesis.
I didn't birdie one. One, I literally threw a different shot every round. Again, my fault, but one of the unfortunate things with, you know, my back issues and stuff was I was very limited in practice. And I threw one of the two shots I threw on one because we did the practice round and then we did the doubles battle. One of the shots that I threw on it was like my straight buzz. And I think it hit a tree. And that's why I think it ended up being parked.
Mm.
And I didn't realize that until probably the second round when I threw the same exact shot or what I thought was the same exact shot. It ended up going all the way through the trees, got on the road, and then rolled 100 feet down the road.
Oh, geez.
So that hole, I was throwing my straight zone. I was trying two different buzzes. I was trying a different shot every round. Couldn't figure it out. Hole two, and we'll get into this a little bit because I want to talk just about how I heard you guys talk about it on Grip Locked, but I want to like really dig in a little bit about how impressive Eagle's win is because I also was not able to throw forehands because of my back. And hole two, that forehand is so easy.
Yeah.
It is such an easy birdie hole if you can throw a forehand. And round four was the first round that my back was feeling good and I was able to kind of throw forehands without, you know, hesitation. And so we couldn't practice hole one because they had a bunch of people up there watching the Jumbotron screen up there and all that stuff. So the TD said that we could practice hole two and hole three. So hole two, I busted out my Zeus and like parked it three times in a row. And I was like, all right, it's a forehand Zeus. I got this hole dialed in. Hole three was getting that drive dialed in because I had just previously gone OB, then whatever, whatever. So we're basically like an hour and a half of just kind of milling around. I know hole one's basket is elevated. So I spent all my practice putting on hole three's basket, which is also elevated. And it was just getting reps at like 20, 25 feet, just feeling that, just waiting. We work our way back to hole one. And he's like, all right, the TZ's like, all right, since this isn't like a part of this tournament, you don't need necessarily have an official with you. You guys just go out and handle it yourselves and then come back and tell us who won. And we're like, all right. So I was like, all right, let's flip. Boom, flip it. It lands. I win the flip. I'm like, I'm going first. And this also was a we also, even though I couldn't practice on hole one, I was simulating that shot on hole two and hole three with my zones and trying to figure it out. So I have this new jawbreaker zone in my bag that I was throwing on hole eight. I was like, let's try that. In practice, it looked really good. And busted it out. And it looked good, 25 feet left. And I was like, all right, finally, I actually have a putt at birdie for this. This guy, this is the crazy thing. This guy, he had a really good backhand, but I guess with just how the hole lined up, he just felt more confident hitting the gap with a forehand. So like he threw like a, and I played with him the previous round. And that's a really hard like flip up turnover forehand.
Yeah.
Touchy shot. He did not do it well in the round we played. He did it really well in the playoff to where it went a little bit too far. So he had like a 34 footer just outside the circle. He barely missed it. I stepped it to my putt, cashed it in, and I was like, let's go. and it was one of those things of where it was so sweet birding that hole after that hole gave me so many struggles when I knew how easy of a hole that was that I was just, every time I birded it, I was like, I'm giving strokes to the field. So that was an incredible feeling. But then also like this tournament was like, if I go back and really like dissect it, it was a pretty much of a letdown for me because I really felt like I could have competed at a much higher level and really put myself more in the mix. And I just kind of wasted a really good opportunity, and I hate wasting opportunities. So getting that USCGC spot made everything a little bit more sweeter. Like that hour and a half drive to Helsinki afterwards would have been absolutely miserable had I lost in that playoff. Because I was sitting in a good spot. You know, I was tied for seventh at one point.
Yeah.
And sitting in a great spot and, you know, fell all the way back to, you know, tied for 16th. And if I would have walked away without a USDGC spot tied for 16th, it would have been like, man, this was just a waste of an opportunity. So that was the USDGC story. Back-to-back years qualifying in a playoff, which is kind of nuts. And it's one of those things, you know, I don't know if you guys are keeping track of like who's qualified and who's not. I think there's probably still a lot of really good players that aren't qualified.
Yeah, there's still a few. Yeah.
It's getting harder and harder to qualify for these things. And, you know, a lot of these Europeans are coming over for a lot of the tournaments the rest of the year. And so they're going to probably take up some spots as well. And it's one of those things like it feels really good having that monkey off your back.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was something that maybe I was a little bitter a little bit with the fact of it's like I got a top three and didn't get a spot just because Innova decides what tournaments they want to do qualifications for and what's not. So like that was kind of one of those things where it's like that would have really sucked had I just didn't qualify basically.
But is it something that
over with
was qualifying something that you think was adding pressure to like every tournament you were playing, like knowing you hadn't qualified yet and the later and later you got in the year? Was that something you were thinking of going into weekends, or was it just like late game situation?
It was the same thing as this. Like I wasn't thinking, I honestly didn't even realize that there was USCGC qualifying until after round one when I went and checked scores on UDisc and saw that the USCGC thing was there.
Yeah.
So I didn't even know that this was an event for it. And like I said, I didn't even pay attention to it until the top 10 situation was out of reach. Once that was out of reach, then it was like, all right, what do I have to do to get this USCGC qualifying? Because the way I was playing it is like, if I play well, I'm going to get it.
Yeah.
Right? If I get fifth at European Open, I'm going to get it. So, yeah. I don't think it was adding any extra stress. It was always just one of those bummers of where, you know, that's kind of been my MO a lot this season, of where I've been on lead cards, I've been on chase cards early in tournaments, and then I've kind of just like fallen off. And even though I did do the same exact thing here, it was nice to finish the last three holes 2 under par to kind of earn that spot. And essentially, fit, you know, the last four holes that mattered, I went 3 under par through the last four holes that mattered for that USGC spot. So that was a good way to kind of keep fighting. And I think too, you know, one thing that I pride myself on is no matter what, I'm always going to try to finish the tournament out as much as I can. I think it's hard to do that sometimes, you know, when you're in 35th place, it's like, who cares? But I think if you, the way I look at it is like, I'm still practicing, like I'm still getting valuable experience. And yeah, I'm not going to end up having the finish that I want. You know, I didn't want a top 16 finish. I did want a top 5 finish at this tournament. And so like, that's a bummer, but it's way too easy to just be like, ah, screw it, I don't really care, and stop grinding.
Yeah.
It's really easy to do that. And it's much, much harder to be like, no, I'm in 35th place. I'm 25 shots out of the lead, but I'm going to be grinding over these 25 footers still. Mm-hmm. And grinding over these 200-foot upshots and all that. So I pride myself on that. And, I did that this tournament. Like, if I would have checked out after, like, hole 3 being even par and just been like, oh, well, this round's going to suck. Like, I'm out of it. No chance. Like, there's no way I'm getting that USGC spot. So.
Yeah, for sure. Now, being in Europe, obviously, I've never had a chance to go there. But it's a tournament that, like, every time I watch it, it looks incredible.
You gotta come.
Yeah. Well, I want to definitely one year make the trip, do some bogey bro battles and stuff over there, but also just get to watch the tournament. But was there stuff that you noticed that the event did differently that you're like, oh, this would be sick if we had in the US? Or was it just like the gallery and the fans, since it's the only time, you know, the pros are over there, was just so massive that it makes the event look that more elusive or exclusive?
Yeah. So I think one of the reasons, too, why there's so many people there is they don't charge for tickets. There's no ticket sales, which I didn't know.
Yeah.
So it's a completely free event. I would say the one thing, the biggest thing that, like, stood out to me of where it's like, oh, wow, this is way different, is the average age of the crowd. Way younger.
Yeah.
Like, at a Pro Tour event, stateside, you might see occasional kids out there, and a lot of times it's, you know, parents and stuff bringing their kids out, and maybe they kind of like disc golf a little bit, but they're not really like,
it's like the parents are into disc golf more so.
Correct. Here it's like you get off 18 and you start walking to scoring. Like, there was a section of where, I mean, there was like 50 to 100 kids by themselves, no parents around. I mean, literally all under the ages of like 14. So, and you can see some kids in like the background of one of our doubles match too. Like, there was like 4 or 5 kids. There were some other kids later on that were watching too. Like, there were just tons of kids out there that were all about it. And that's like a big difference than what you see kind of in the States. And even what you see like at your local disc golf course. Like, if you go to your local disc golf course, you're probably not seeing like 3 or 4 12-year-olds playing together on the course. So that was the thing that stood out the most to me. Obviously, the big kind of big pieces of, you know, if you want to call it technology or like the grandstands and all that stuff, like how 18 was set up was incredible. Having the big TV on one, I thought was a great idea, because then you literally could have people just chilling on one all day and watching everyone go through, because then they would put, they would put the coverage up there as well. I thought that was really, really cool. There still are some, like, you know, kinks to obviously work out as more and more people, you know, come in. I think there are some kinks of where, you know, like the player parking was right next to right in between hole 1 and hole 2. So when you parked, if you were like warming up or doing anything in there and like someone had just finished hole 1 and was walking over, you would a lot of times get like, you know, the spectators and stuff coming up to you right there in the parking lot. And, you know, there, which is like, again, not that big of a deal, but it becomes a deal, big of a deal when you plan out like, okay, I want to get to the course an hour before. So I have this, this, and this. And then like, you know, you might have a line of 10 people asking for photos and an autograph. And at a certain point you have to tell them like, I can't. And like, that's always like an awkward thing. So they, I would say that was one thing they probably will have to look into next year is more roping. And even like one issue that we had was when we were on hole 16, lead card was on hole 10 and they kind of like buddy up to each other. And so there was a lot of people that were trying to cross hole 16's fairway to get to hole 11 to where the lead card was about to go. And there's no like real ropes and stuff set up. So people were just going and we're just there by ourselves on hole 16. And we're trying, you know, there's a fine line too of where like pros need to get better at being able to throw when there's people walking 300 feet away, not in your direction. Like there was a little bit too much of that for my liking of where pros were like, everyone in my proximity needs to stop moving. I don't think we need to go that far, but like when pros are crossing or when spectators are crossing the fairway that you're trying to throw on, that's a safety issue. So that was like really the only thing that I was like, they might need to tweak for next year just because of how many spectators are out there. But overall, I will say this, when you, since you haven't been over there, when you watch it, what is the vibe of like where the course is? What vibe do you get of like, do you get like, it's like a Jonesboro of where it's like secluded off by itself in its own little spot? Do you get like it's a Winthrop where you're like on a campus and there's like stuff happening all around? Like what vibe do you get of the course?
Kind of in between those two. Like some holes it feels like obviously there's the one where like the OB line runs across the soccer field. So like there's a few, few, and you're throwing near fences. There's a few times you see that, but then there's also some holes that seem like they're just completely off on their own and like there's nothing around it.
Yeah. Watching coverage, because obviously I watched as much coverage as I could before I got out there.
Yeah.
I was surprised with how like many streets were by with cars, and because the way they film it is unbelievable. Like they film it so good to where it does look like, obviously, yes, there are fences and stuff like that, but there are so many holes where you're like playing and there's like literally a street 10 feet away from you.
Oh, geez.
And I felt like you don't get that at all in coverage. They do such a good job of filming it to where it feels like you're kind of on a disc golf course and nothing else is around you, really.
Yeah.
I was actually kind of surprised with how like that wasn't the case at all.
Well, that was one of the reasons I kind of got that feel this year was this was the first year that we've been doing the podcast and had to do a European Open preview show, because the last time it happened was 2019 and we weren't doing preview shows back then. So this is the first time I needed to like really study the event before it versus just watch the coverage. And so I was looking at the caddy book and they had the aerial map, and I always love looking at like how far some of the walks are. And like this course, it really, like when I looked at it on an aerial map, I was like, wow, this is not the layout I expected at all. Like there was a lot of walks and I'm like, that walk is so much longer than I ever would have thought.
There's one walk that's legitimately maybe 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like I was looking at it, way longer. This is crazy. The layout of it from that aerial map, obviously I don't get context of being there, but the layout on the aerial map was drastic. It was similar to my first time stepping on USDGC's campus.
Yeah.
And I saw hole one and like the pro shop's right behind hole one, and then hole two was right there. USDGC, watching it just coverage year after year after year, and then I stepped foot on the campus, I was like, wow, being here just does not feel like the same course. And I could definitely see where that'd be the vibe of the European Open. I could see that for sure.
Yeah.
One question I had, because obviously we're not going to get into talk through the whole Nico situation and all of that, but I did have a question about, because obviously it was an official that called him on it, right?
He was on our card the next day.
That's what I was going to ask. Was it something where there was just more officials out there? Was it one official just bouncing around? Like, was that something you noticed at all?
Yeah, I think I think what they're doing right now, this is pure speculation. I think what they're doing right now is for coverage reasons, having an official on those cards that are like primarily getting videoed, speeds up play and speeds up coverage and kind of just helps things go. That's kind of my look. I think also I love having officials out there. Now, would I love them like just walking with one card? Probably not. I'd like it more if they were kind of bouncing around and a little bit more mobile to where if someone did have like a rules question, because like we had, I would say most pros know the rules pretty well, but there are a lot of times where you'll get in a situation where you're just like, I'm not entirely sure what's the right way of playing this. And I know what's his name. Was it Big Dog or whatever?
Yeah.
We'll tell you to play a provisional and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, people want to just try to play it the right way. So, you know, do you know what the rule is for casual relief? Like, do you have to play it at the as soon as the spot that you can play it from? You have to play it from there, or can you just keep going back as far as you want?
It should be the first safe spot, but it's like a little bit arbitrary.
Yeah, because that's kind of a gray area.
Yeah.
Here's another one. So my lie, like where my disc was, I could put my foot behind where my disc was and not be in casual water. But where I wanted to have my second foot, not my pivot foot, but where I wanted to have my second foot, that was going to be in casual water. So like that was another one, like where I was like, do I get relief? Because
no, I think your lie is technically not in it. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
But it's a good question, because like it's a part of your stance.
Correct, and those are just things that, you know, sometimes, you know, it's nice just to have someone that knows the rules, you know, like the back of their hand, knows all the different scenarios, and can just like. But then again, like, I don't know if you guys heard this on coverage, but I don't know if it was during FPO or what, but I heard someone say, I couldn't see who it was, but I heard someone say, like one of the officials say, like, oh, benefit goes to the player. And I've talked to like one of the head officials. That's not a rule. That's never a rule. There is nothing in there that says benefit goes to the player.
The yes and no. If it's the tiebreaker. So if it's a card and I say it's an inbounds,
no.
If I say it's inbounds, you say it's in, I'll find
Show
it.
Show it to me.
It's in there.
I'm telling you, this guy right here, this guy told he's the rule dude. And he told me that's not a rule. Benefit to the player is not a rule. But yeah,
people are saying Hunter's right.
Benefit of the doubt comes into play as a tiebreaker when the group can't make a decision. For example, if two players see the disc is safe, two see it as OB, then basically the tiebreaker is the benefit of the player. That's when like the PDGA is answering questions about the rules.
Wait, it says that?
I don't know if that's in the rule book, but the PDGA answering questions on how to interpret the rules says that. So basically on a card of four, if it's 2-2, the benefit goes to the player.
Oh, that's in response to a question.
Yeah, it's basically asking how to interpret the rules, and it's saying if it's 2-2, it goes.
Okay, so it's not officially a rule.
It's not like if everyone on your card is just like it's unclear that they can't really. Is it supposed to be you make a statement? Most people say it's unclear, so I'm gonna give it to you, and that's them saying it's inbounds. It's really supposed to only come up to inbounds, but this is saying like 2-2. Then the PDGA is taking the stance of benefit goes to the player if it's split down the middle on a card. Two people say it's in, two people say it's out, benefit to the player.
Yeah, I'll have to.
But it's not like, I don't know, benefit goes to the player, you're in, which is how it gets said a lot.
Yes, that is, I think that was the point he was making.
Yeah.
Of where you're like, I don't know, it's too close, benefit goes to the player.
Yeah, there is no such thing as too close to call.
That is exactly right. What you just said right there is what I was saying. I think a lot of people think
that's what people think it is. That's not a rule.
That's not it. Yeah, it's when what you just said makes sense. Of where if it's tied 2-2, then the player gets the good call, I guess.
Yeah.
But if it's something where everyone's just like no one, you know, one of those situations where no one wants to piss off the person, and there's like, sure, I guess benefit goes to the player. Like, that's not a thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It was a while ago. I knew, because I was like, there's no way this guy just lied.
No, because it's basically like, that's just a cop-out. Like, essentially, if the disc is either inbounds or out of bounds, and as a rules official on the card, as a PDGA member, it's your job to make the call and say, that's in or that's out. You can't just be like, basically what ends up people doing is like being like, I don't know, man, benefit to the player. That's you just saying it's inbounds, like, at the end of the day.
Correct.
Is how it ends up going. But that does get said incorrectly a lot. But yeah, I mean, I saw the same official. I only saw that one official on coverage, the one who ended up calling Nico. So I didn't know if he was just bouncing around.
There was another one, okay. I believe.
Because on final day lead card on hole 16 with the bunker rule, Kevin Jones had thrown two in, and then he walked over to the official and was like, I want to throw those discs again. What's like, how do I do that?
I was on that card, Hunter.
So that wasn't the final day.
I was right there.
That was third day.
That was third round.
Okay, yeah. Because then, obviously, the official was like, you have 30 seconds to go get it and come back.
Let's talk about hole 16 because let's talk about that real quick because that was the one situation I want to bring up.
That was kind of a baller move by Kevin KJ because then he was just like, oh, okay, and then he just grabbed a completely different disc, threw the forehand and parked it and just like walked off. And I was like, that was kind of sick because I was throwing that straight in the bunker again. If the dude just told me, you got 30 seconds to sprint, grab that disc and come back, I'd be like, all right, well, here goes my whole bag into the bunker.
So I never played with anyone that really, really struggled on that hole.
Yeah.
At most, I think it was like three throws of like in a row. I definitely played with, I think I played with maybe that someone that had like four or five OB between the two shots. But I definitely watched on the tee pad, or you could see people from hole 10 and hole 11 playing that hole as well. And hole 17. So I definitely saw sometimes. And also the other thing that you would do is like when you're walking from 15 to 16, you'd kind of walk through 16's fairway and you would sometimes see people like put their bag on and like half their bag's gone. And you're like, oh, jeez, man, they do a lot of shots. So the interesting thing about 16, obviously we kind of just talked about it a little bit, but where people were throwing their tee shot required, like a 300 to 325 foot shot.
Yeah.
Now you could lay up and have like a 200 foot shot. So like the interesting thing here is like, there comes a time where you're starting to like throw discs of where you're like, this is not going to really get onto the green. So then it's like, do you then lay up? Because then if you lay up, you really only probably have like four or five discs from the layup spot to get on. And then from there, it's like, what, you're going to start trying to throw like a, you know, your distance driver 200 feet. Like that doesn't sound fun. So yeah, Kevin was basically saying like, I want to use those discs that I just threw. And essentially the only way you could use those discs is you basically would just get a courtesy warning. Right. So you would go up, get your disc, come back, get a courtesy warning for taking more than 30 seconds and then throw without a penalty.
It's not a, is it a warning anymore? I think it's straight to penalty now.
No, it's a courtesy warning.
It's not a courtesy. It's a time violation. It's a different rule. Courtesy is a warning. Time violation is a violation. I'm pretty sure you play from wherever it lands with a stroke penalty at this point.
Wait, what? What are you talking about? When,
if you take more than 30 seconds to throw, that's a time violation. Courtesy
isn't this
warning.
The whole thing with Nico? Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The first one's a warning. So yeah, he
I
goes
don't think
up there
it is anymore.
Him, comes back.
I don't think time violation is anymore. Is it?
Yes. Nico got
footfault,
warned.
Footfault.
Nico got
footfault. So I'm thinking of. Yeah. You're right.
Nico.
You're right.
Nico
time violation's one warning.
Chandler, yeah, Nico and Chandler Kramer both got a courtesy warning for taking too long.
You're correct.
And then Nico ended up getting another one. Chandler didn't.
The footfault rule used to be the exact same, and they changed the footfault rule to now it's just straight to a stroke.
Yeah.
I got them flipped in my
head. So basically, Kevin, if he really wanted to, he could have walked up, grabbed those discs, come back, got a courtesy warning thrown, and then as long as he doesn't get another one,
it doesn't really
matter.
Yeah.
Do those reset every round? Those have to reset.
Yeah, they reset.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So then he would only have to play 17, 18, not do anything stupid. So, but that's an interesting hole 16, such an interesting one. I really would love to see you and Trevor play it because, luckily for me, I only threw one OB the entire tournament on that hole. I actually played that hole 300 par. So, oh no, sorry. I missed one of my birdie putts on the island. Sad. But no, I played that hole pretty good, but I definitely like the nerves on the first shot onto the island are pretty high. And then the one time I did miss it long, like that second, like it elevates ridiculously high. So I think it's kind of interesting because it probably like keeps going up, but then there's a certain point of you've thrown so many that it probably drops to where it's just like, at this point, I don't even care.
Yeah. I'm throwing seven.
Well, yeah,
do you like that there's no OB stroke with it?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah, because it could get really, really bad.
I want to say the first year, it was just normal stroke and distance. So you advanced to where you like crossed out, which was typically not that much farther in front of you.
Yeah, I don't like that as much.
Stayed there with the OB.
You're saying advanced to the island?
No. Where it was an island green, but it was like, so it was essentially stroke and distance. There was no drop zone. If I remember correctly, like one of the early years, 2015 or so, and you, because I remember players taking very big numbers, I believe you just moved up to the OB line. So a lot of times players were throwing a forehand, and so they were going out basically 30 feet in front of them. So they were having to rethrow basically the same shot 30 feet closer with the OB penalty. And then it was a relatively newer development, the no penalty.
Yeah, I like not moving. I mean, I think with how disc golf is right now, I think it makes sense, like with the scoring and stuff for that hole, I think it makes sense to play that way because, like I said, it could get really bad real fast for some people. I mean, look, if you go and look, it's not just the people that were finishing bottom. Like there are some people that finished in the top 50 at that tournament that took sevens, eights, and nines on that hole. So what would that end up being?
That could probably be like a 13.
And I also think it makes the strategy a lot more interesting because the fact that you know that it's only one, it makes you like feel like, all right, well, I'm just going to go for it again. Where I think if it was stroke and distance, like, well, with a penalty included, I think a lot of people would chip up and like just play for a four.
Just play for a four every time.
Similar to how like a lot of F3O players played it.
Yeah, I'm surprised that's not something we see more at other tournaments. Because like obviously this wasn't an X major. Like the PDGA must have given a waiver or whatever to allow it. Because like it's outside the normal scope of the PDGA rules, but it's not like USDGC where it's an X major. So obviously the PDGA is cool with that. I'm surprised that's not something other tournaments have implemented, because like that's a quick way to like add some drama down the stretch.
I think it's the best thing to do on the par fours, because I hate drop zones on par fours.
Yeah,
I absolutely despise drop zones. I don't think they should exist on par fours, and I think this is the solution. Like I wouldn't like that rule on like a par three necessarily, where it's just like you just keep reteeing.
Yeah, yeah,
and you don't get a penalty stroke. I like the idea of like you get a penalty stroke and then you go to a drop zone, which is like a little bit of an easier tee shot than what you were just doing.
Or a chance of throwing it in from, you know, 200 feet, 100 feet out to save three.
No, I don't like drop zones that short, Hunter. Come on.
You don't like a 100-foot drop zone? I know you don't like 50 or 60.
No, I hate it. No, because you take the whole.
So well, like, well, you still got to cross the water. Like hole 8, Maple Hill, you still got to cross the water, but it's like 150 feet now.
I don't like that. That's not hard. Like, don't do Maple Hill, because I haven't played. I can't talk about Maple Hill. I haven't played it.
I haven't played it either. I want to.
Do DDO. Do DDO hole 16 at Emporia.
So you don't like where the drop zone is currently?
No, I think the drop zone should be the FPO tee pad,
which is more on the right.
And you're still having to throw like a full shot,
yeah,
not a jump putt.
Yeah. That's fair.
I think you still have to throw. For me, I like having the drop zones where you still have to throw a full shot.
That makes sense.
But going back to it, I think this solves a lot of problems with like, you know, island greens and stuff like that for par fours, and they don't know where to put the drop zone or how you do OBs, because it's like, okay, well, if you go OB on your drive, do you go to the drop? like all that weird stuff, just make it bunker rule. I like that. Like that could be really interesting for, here's the thing. I think having more different variations of hazards and penalties and all that stuff is a really good thing, as long as you can make it very simple of like what it is and make it to where like the viewer knows like, oh, those are all yellow stakes. So yeah, that's the bunker rule. Like if you can make it that way, I think it's great to have different things, because certain holes, OB is going to make more sense than the bunker rule, and stroke and distance is going to make more sense than not, you know, I think that. So now talking about hole 16, let's talk real quick just about the course in general. I, you know, because normally after I play a tournament for the first time and play a course, I have my critiques and all that stuff of like holes that I don't like and yada, yada, yada. There are only, I believe, two holes on this course that don't belong. You have 16 great holes. Two holes.
Which two?
Hole 8, which used to be actually, hole 8 was the hole that everyone birdied. It's a 260-foot shot. The basket was on like a little bit of a hill. Everyone just threw it uphill, had a birdie putt, and moved on.
Yeah.
It doesn't really necessarily belong. Hole 8 used to be a really good hole, apparently, but they built in like a parking lot or something like that. So they had to like, they couldn't use the tee pad that they normally were using. So like hole 8, the reason why it doesn't belong is like, it's just a birdie hole. Like everyone's birding it. It's not a hard hole. So it doesn't really, like, it's really hard to bogey that hole, really easy to birdie. And then the only other one that I had was, why did I say 10? Oh, not 10, 11. 11 is the other one where you're throwing the one that Paul skipped off the water.
Oh, the like big hyzer.
Big hyzer, yeah. That's the only, out of all 18 holes, that's the only shot that you're throwing a shot and you're hoping. That's the only poke and pray hole out of all 18 holes. So that one to me doesn't belong. I think they just need to remove a tree or something, kind of like open that gap up a little bit to where players are actually like consistently hitting it. Cause I know Eagle too, like some of his shots like went through the trees and didn't go OB on that hole.
Yeah.
So that's where it's just like,
there's a lot more luck in that hole. Yeah,
exactly. That's the only hole that really there was luck involved. Yeah. In my opinion, every other hole, if you threw a good shot, you were awarded.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, for a major, the course was incredible. And yeah, I just wanted to go through that. I think it's the best finishing four holes out of any course I've played.
It's a big compliment. I agree. I mean, I think what keeps it interesting is year after year, it's pretty much never over down the stretch. This year, obviously, there's a two-horse race, and it was like 16 strokes to third. But still, coming down the stretch, it wasn't over until like even Eagle's putt on 18. I was like, he technically could miss that, like knowing it's for his a major win like that. Like it wasn't a tap in putt on 18, but
no,
every single shot was demanding. There wasn't, you don't get to that final stretch and you're like, all right, I can relax on this hole. Like you don't get that.
Well, you also don't see Eagle fist pump after his tee shot on 18
because it's
on a hole that's a hole that's easy.
Yeah,
like that's a hard tee shot, and you know, seeing his emotion of like, boom, execute it, let's go, like that just shows you how difficult that shot was, that he was super pumped up about that. But
my favorite, they showed it was round three's Eagle's tee shot. He shanked, allegedly, he pulled it right. And they showed like he pulled it to the right, but whatever disc still, like, I think he was planning on flipping something up dead straight, and he flipped it up to the right and it pushed far enough that it cut the corner and he ended in the fairway. And so on they like showed his face with him.
Par 5?
Hole 18.
Oh, hole 18. Oh,
I say hole 8. Okay. Yeah, no, hole 18. Yeah. So he like pulled it and it like flipped up and like showed his reaction. You could tell he was just like pissed at himself. Cause like the commentators are talking about, oh my word, he got aggressive there. Like, what a great shot. They're like, we're actually getting word. He didn't want to do that. And they cut to his reaction cam and like replayed it. And you can see like he was pretty pissed. And then like he slowly watched it. And then it like landed in bounds. And then he like fist pumped and was super stoked. And I thought it was pretty funny because like,
yeah,
I was like, that when it's your weekend, it's just your weekend. Because like he thought I threw OB early is what he was thinking, because he flipped it and it was just covering OB. And then it just pushed through everything and it was in bounds like in way up there. I was like, dang, that's just how stuff was rolling. Sick. Yeah. That's pretty funny. But the coverage, you probably didn't get to watch much MPO coverage. I'm willing to say it was the best live event they've ever done.
I heard you guys say that. That's awesome.
It was incredible. It was great. Awesome. We got to see so much golf. The commentary did good.
I think Brian's good in the booth too, huh?
Brian needs someone like Nate. So if you put Brian alone with one other person in the booth, I forget what tournament it was. He struggled a little bit. But the Brian-Nate combo is both doing color, really, I think, fed off each other. Because Brian has enough knowledge to be able to provide insight, but also to be able to clarify Nate's insight. So if Nate says something, mm-hmm. Brian has enough course knowledge and stuff like that to be able to like dig a little deeper and get more out of Nate, which is why I think Nate shines so much. Because Nate obviously has tons of knowledge, but sometimes like when he says it, if you don't also have tons of knowledge, it's like it doesn't make sense, or it just doesn't, you're like, that dude doesn't know what he's talking about. But then Brian was able to like ask a follow-up question and Nate was able to like clarify what he's saying, and then you're like, oh, that's genius. Because even like my favorite thing that made me go, that was like great commentary, was they Ian or Brian asked him about the rain on the course and how the course is going to play different. And Nate had been out to the European Open enough, plenty of times, and he was like, well, you know, with the grass, they cut the grass a lot shorter in the fairways and a lot thicker out. He's like, so people are going to have to pay attention to fairway skips. They're probably going to actually speed up a little bit, but off the fairway, you're not going to get nearly the same skips you were getting, you know, the day before. Whether or not that was true sounded incredible. And me at home, I'm like, I was like, oh, that's such great insight. Like, that's the type of stuff that you learn from a pro there. Like, it felt great sitting at home listening. So, yeah. And also,
I mean,
the whole round, like, that you were popping up on coverage, you were blowing their minds with how far you threw. It was very funny.
Maybe my form looks that bad that people are like, there's no way that goes far. I don't know.
They kept cutting to where your drives landed, and like they'd be like, and here's Brody's upshot for the eagle on hole three or whatever. And every time they'd cut, Nate Dawson would be like, did they say that wrong? That's his upshot on this hole. And they're like, yeah. He's like, his drive landed there every time. It was very funny. After like the third time, I was just like dying laughing, and Brian kept going, I'm telling you guys, he throws far. I've played with him. He throws so much farther than people think. It was pretty funny.
Do you remember hole 13? The eagle was throwing rollers on this hole, and it was just like there's a gap off the thing. It goes up the hill and then it drastically goes to the left. There's one big tree in front of the basket, and there's like a big fall off behind the basket, but he was like throwing a roller and it was like going up the right hand side and then cutting all the way down the hill.
He
almost had like a jump cut or something on a hole. I turned over one of my forehands, like I was trying to throw like a hyzer flip forehand through the gap, and like I turned it over a little bit and got sneaky on the left hand side and like got way up there. And I had like 200 feet in or something. And I was like, this has to be the best drive ever on this hole.
Yeah.
And someone's like, nah, man, Eagle had like a jump putt with a roller. I was like, what?
Yeah.
I was like, how do you throw a roller? Let's talk about that real quick, though. Let's talk about that, because obviously, let's not talk about that, man. For some reason, peanuts are like the only food that has a way of like perfectly getting into your throat to like make you feel like you're choking.
Maybe you're allergic.
No, I don't want to say that because I love peanuts too much. But yeah, so coming into the tournament, I was in a similar boat as Eagle, where I wasn't able to throw forehands. And so being in that position of like not being able to really throw power forehands at all. I was still throwing like forehands on upshots and stuff. It is, I just want to say how stupidly impressive it is with how well he scored, because that course without a forehand becomes so much harder.
Yeah.
Like when I played it the final day and I was throwing forehands, there were so many holes that were like, oh my God, this hole's so much easier. Because we play holes, right, where you can step up and you're like, you can be like, oh, there's a backhand line, there's a forehand line, and it's like whichever one you feel more confident, do that. There are a lot of holes. I mean, most of the holes on this course are like that. The only thing though is like the forehand line is like way up here in the sense of if you have a good forehand, your birdie rate's going to go way up versus the backhand. Sure, you can still birdie it with the backhand, but the rate's so much lower. So playing that course 2.5 rounds or 3 rounds or whatever without throwing a forehand and just seeing how Eagle was able to score as well as he did, I don't know. I know people are talking about it and we're saying, yeah, it's impressive and whatnot. I don't think people knew how so many of these holes fit for forehand.
Well, that's what I was asking on Grip Lock, because like you can kind of tell from watching at home and also watching for years, you know, players choosing forehands on certain holes. But I mean, it's similar to, in my head, to USDGC, where like there's just some shots where like being able to look at the target and throw, and you just know that shot shape, you're just a lot more comfortable landing in bounds. To where that's why I think at USDGC, forehand dominant players do so much better. And obviously, I think there's a reason that Chandler Kramer was able to hang around on lead card.
Yeah.
I was thinking in my head, I'm like, you know, Eagle had one of, if not the best forehands, power forehands in the game, which is what was required a lot of times on this course. Like, could he have shot better out there with it? Trevor made a good counterpoint of it probably it simplified the game a lot more to where like you didn't have to make decisions but it was impressive.
Hole two, he birdies every time.
Yeah, versus he birdied it once, bogeyed it once.
Hole 17, he probably gets it twice, maybe three times.
Yeah.
And then a couple of those par fours, here's a question for you. Do you think that course is long? Do you think it's a long course?
Overall, I would say, I would say it's a long course if I played it, but I think compared to tour, I wouldn't say it's a long course.
Yeah. It's actually a short course.
Yeah.
It's actually, I would say one of the shorter courses in the sense of there weren't really, other than 18, really 18 might have been the only par, just because the second shot's so uphill that it plays, you know, I think I had like roughly around 325 to 340 into that basket at every round, but it played more like 400 or so with how high it goes up. But yeah, all the par fours on that course are very like, again, I don't know if this came over on coverage. You're going to score really well out there if you hit the first initial gap on, and then who cares where it goes after that. If you can hit the first initial gap on all these par fours, you're going to birdie probably half of the par fours.
Yeah, there were several they said like, this is all that's important here is just get out there. Like just correct. Get far down the fairway. You'll have something.
Correct. Because there was just, and that's one of the reasons why I was actually scoring good. I would say not great, but good is like, I could not hit the gaps. I missed so many gaps. Hole 12, which is like a lot of people play that as the backhand roller up the hill. There's a big tree on the right. I hit the tree all four rounds. So I was getting like 100 feet, 75 feet off the tee pad. I played a lot of the par fours where like I was throwing my second shot to where people were throwing their drives. And then I was having to get up and down from there for par. And like when I got to that spot, I was like, oh my gosh, this par is so easy, or getting up and down from here is so easy. So it was one of those where like the people that were really successful and shot really well they were just constantly giving themselves chances at birdies.
Yeah.
And if you hit a tree early or you missed the gap, a birdie was pretty much automatically off the table. But it was probably a lot harder to get bogeys out there than birdies on those type of holes. Now, obviously, the back nine opens up lots of OB, different story. But all right. I have a couple more things. Did you have a couple more things or what?
No, I don't really have much more. I just have a question or two about D-Glo, but we'll get to that later.
Okay. This also, I say this every time, we need cuts at every event. Every event, whether it's a three-day event, four-day event, we need cuts. This one was after three rounds. Would have loved it to see it after two. But Sunday was unbelievably 10 times better than every round. Like,
just pace of play we had
20 minutes in between each group instead of like 12.
Yeah.
And then you're also cutting off all the people that are shooting 15, 18 over par, and the rounds just went so much more smoother. And I think everyone enjoyed it, probably the spectators as well. So I will just continue to harp on saying, let's keep pushing for cuts, more cuts. And this is coming from a person that will be fighting to make the cut on multiple tournaments. So, all right. UDIS World Rankings.
Well, I haven't checked them.
I went up one spot.
No way. Dude.
Yeah.
I think I've determined that the UDIS World Rankings just weighs history so heavily.
I'm here.
What is that? Who's here? What was that, Silas?
I'm not sure I understand.
What is going on? Hold on. We're talking to Siri right now, mid-show. All right, you're back.
I think when the UDIS World Rankings came out, they were so new, they were shiny, everyone loved them. This is incredible. But now that we see it more, I think it's also, the problem is it's not really putting any benefits on people that play events.
Yeah.
So like you can just kind of sit back and hand pick the six or seven tournaments that you want to play. And, I don't know. That's my one rant, because I was like, oh, top 16. All right. Let's see it. Cause I'm not like, it's not like I'm 20th in the world right now. And I got a top 16. And I'm expecting to jump up into the top 15. I'm like 60 something in the world. Yeah. So I'm like, oh, I just got top 16 at a major. Let's see how many spots I moved up. And it's like,
it just doesn't affect your dominance index. What this, where did Christian end?
I think he's like moved up eight spots. I think he's like 52. I think he's a little bit above me. I saw him too.
No, yeah, that's what I'm saying. He moved up quite a bit. Christian.
No, but he's like, no, his name's Chandler, but.
No, I'm talking Christian. Christian Kuoksa.
Who the heck is that?
Someone ahead of you in the world rankings. You know him, man. You're chasing him down. Here he is.
Who is that?
Wait, I just want to see where he finished. I want to see where he finished.
Did he even play in that tournament?
He came in eighth. Makes sense. I'll say his dominance index went up 1.9. Yours went up 0.65. So he moved up 12 spots. So he jumped you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, see, the dominance index thing is a weird one, because I don't know. I don't understand the whole ELO thing in a tournament format. I understand it 1v1. I don't understand it when it's like, I don't know.
It is frustrating. It's like people aren't like you just don't have to show up, and like you just never show up and then like play like a few events a year and like no one's gonna touch you.
Yeah, I just basically have to start getting top fives. But that's my one rant on the UDIS World Rankings. We'll keep you up to date on, because that's one of my goals. I have a bunch of goals that I'm going to eventually make public at the end of the year. And I have a goal in mind on where I want to end up the year in the world rankings. And let's just say it's difficult right now to move up at all.
You got pro tour points though, didn't you?
What? I got some. Yeah, I got some of those.
Because the Pro Tour weighs majors somewhat heavily, don't they?
Yeah, I got some of those. a couple, like Chandler passed me, a couple people that finished ahead of me passed me. But yeah. Yeah, that's going to come down to the wire too. That's going to be an interesting race on who gets in.
The big thing to look at is Eagle's not registered for anything but Worlds from here on out, rest of the season.
He'll still get in.
He's on the bubble.
I think he's going to do well enough at Worlds to get enough points.
I'm sure he will. I mean, you get 150 points for winning a major. So if he wins Worlds, that'll move him up quite a bit.
The interesting thing to look at, though, is to see how many points are required to make it in this year versus last year, because last year the number was so low because you had all the top guys still getting all the top points.
Yeah.
Where this year, the top guys have like fallen off in a lot of tournaments. So a lot of other people are getting points. So I wouldn't be surprised
last year, Zachariah Johnson got in. He was 32nd with 219 points. This year,
where's 219 right now?
Where would that put him right now? Yeah, I mean, we're only partway into the season. 219 right now, you're at 218.49, so about 32nd. So pretty close, but I don't know when the drop, how many drops are going to... No, drops are already being factored in, so there's just a lot of points on the table.
Yeah, not to everyone though, and majors too. Like majors, we have two more majors left.
Yeah.
So yeah, my guess is like it's going to probably take 50 more points or something like that.
Yeah, it should definitely take more. It seems like
maybe like 275. So that's an interesting thing. All right, last thing I have on the table. I know you guys talked about it a little bit. FPO playing the same tees.
Yes. I don't, it's something that in Europe, it's very common, but I don't understand it.
What do we think about that?
I think because... that Paige loves it and she should love it because I think it gives Paige, Evelina, Kat a huge advantage over anyone that would have shown up.
They only have to beat like three people.
Well, yeah, it takes the majority of the field out of the tournament completely.
Here's the thing with disc golf, and I don't know if we've talked about this on the podcast or not, but you look at golf, okay? You never see anyone play a par four where they go layup, 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 or wait, layup, layup, pitch, par. No one ever plays a par four like that in golf.
Yeah.
Right? But you see that all the time in FPO and sometimes in MPO too, of where some, and I think you're going to see that a lot in D-Glo too. We'll talk about this in a little bit, of where someone is literally stepping on the tee pad and going, I can play this hole 100 times and birdie it maybe once.
Mm-hmm.
So why the heck am I going to try to birdie it? So then there's like, well, I'm just going to play it for par. And when you play it for par, the hole becomes way easy, right?
Yeah.
To par it. Just because of just how a lot of these disc golf holes are kind of set up. Now, I will say like hole 15, I would probably like to see them shrink that layup zone even more than it was. But still, that layup was difficult. Like we saw people going into the trees on the right. Some people even were going OB with that layup. So I like that fact of where it's like, if you want to lay up and not even try to get the birdie on this hole, it's not a 100% given of like, oh, I'm definitely getting a par every single time. But watching FPO play, like, I mean, there are just some holes that people just cannot birdie. Like they just have no chance at birdieing. And so if you're playing and it's like, if me and you were to play a long course,
yeah.
Okay, like let's say, well, D-Glo is a perfect example. It's a long course that has a lot of uphill, which makes it even longer. You probably could birdie 12 of the holes out here.
Mm-hmm.
I can birdie 18 of the holes. So, like, right there, I have a massive advantage over you.
Yeah.
Just because I can birdie. Now, obviously, in your situation, like, that's on you. Like you got to learn how to throw further.
Yeah.
But when it comes to like FPO, of where they're playing a hole that is just like ridiculously long. And besides the fact of like the whole thing, like, let's just talk about like, do we want to see tournaments where the winner's 18 over par? Because I think this was, I think this was an eye opener for a lot of people, right? Because a lot of people talk about like, oh, well, they should just, you know, if they played an MPO, they would kick their butt. And this was a course that we both played the same exact layout. And what place would they have made? What was the cut for MPO? Do you even know?
I'm not sure.
What made the cut?
European Open. Let's search it.
I just don't know if this is like the best for the FPO game.
It's not. I don't think so.
Of showing off their skills. Like,
let's see.
If I was playing a hole,
the cut was two over par. Two over par did not make the cut.
Yeah, so not a single FPO player would have made the cut.
No.
Yeah, so like putting myself in their shoes, essentially, like if I walked up to a par four and I was like, if I throw two of my best shots ever on this hole, I will never birdie it. And now I'm basically playing it by throwing a buzz, and making a par. Like, that's so boring. Like, I think that's so boring. Yeah. And so lame.
Well, Paige was basically saying, like, she was advocating for that style of course, saying like, this helps display our game. I'm on the same page as you. I don't think it does.
I think it doesn't.
Because I think it's just shot. Yeah.
I mean, what was third place? 20 something over par?
Somewhere in there, yeah. It went like 12, 15, and then up to that. But my thing was,
how does that? I don't know if that shows. I don't know.
Which I understand somewhat of the argument of like par is irrelevant or whatever. Sure. But
it's not though when you have other people playing it and are shooting 40 under.
Well, yes and no. But I think it's more so like par might be irrelevant, but the shots, like if you're looking at a hole and you're like, it's going to take me four easy shots to get there, or I can try to kill one shot, possibly kill another shot, then I have a birdie putt or a putt for three, you're going to choose the, you know, just lay up, boom. Why wouldn't I? Like, it makes the most sense. And so, like, to me, that's just much more boring from the fan's perspective to watch versus if you shorten that hole or you do whatever you need to do, then, like, it's a lot more exciting to watch Paige try to go for a green or watch Paige bomb a tee shot, because if I take the risk on the tee shot, I'm going to have an easier approach. That's much more exciting to me, regardless of score, par, any of that. Those are the shots that are more exciting. And when you're playing a layout that you, like, there's, like you were saying, there's just some holes where there's no shot, then it just forces you to throw more boring shots. It's just how it ends up working.
Here's also a great comparison between the MPO and the FPO side playing the same course, okay? If I throw a bad shot on a par four out there in MPO, I have no chance probably to birdie it. Really no chance. Mm-hmm. If someone throws a good shot, they have a chance to birdie it. Now you flip that to FPO. Someone throws a bad shot in FPO, they have no chance to birdie it, but they probably still are going to make a par. Someone throws a good shot in FPO, they still don't have a chance to birdie it. That's like you're taking away this like notion of like actually playing disc golf. Like, there is no more of this like risk reward. There is no risk reward.
Yeah.
Like, there really was no risk reward, because there's so many situations where the risk is so high in the sense of where it's like, this is a one in a million shot. Why the heck would I ever try this one in a million shot? So, that's where it's just like, I just think watching them play that course is just not as fun. Like, obviously some holes still work, right? Like hole, one still works, hole, four, five, seven, there's still like a handful of holes that still work. But there's a lot of holes that, like, even on the MPO side, like, I would consider, like, hole 11, for example, Like hole 11, I'm throwing, you know, my nuke hyzer, like big hyzer on it. And it's like, if I was having to try to throw that shot, like with like a flex distance driver, like that would be a nightmare. So I just think, do you want the FPO to be playing a completely different game? And my view is like, they should be playing the same as that game, just at their length.
Yeah.
Right. Like if you want the landing zone for MPO to be 450 feet, then make the landing zone for FPO 375 feet. So we're throwing the same shots. Like we're being asked to throw the same shots, but the holes and course are set up for our distances.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, I don't know.
Especially, I think it's especially important in major, because I do think that part of, I think, Paige's frustration comes from U.S. Women's was they went too far the opposite way, in my opinion. I don't think the courses pushed the FPO field as much as they could have or should have, to where it was similar to, like, if me and you went and played New London, you're going to beat me every single time, no doubt. You're the better player. I can't compete. You and I go play Peaksview, which is a par 3 pitch and putt. I got a shot at beating you.
You can lose to anyone.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can lose to anyone.
So, like, there is too far the other direction. Like, you still want the best player from that weekend to win. You don't want to make it where it's like, all right, well, every single hole is birdieable for the entire field and there's no danger anywhere. So it's just who's making putts today. Like, that's all it comes down to. You want it to still be challenging, but like you're saying, you want them to be playing the same game. So essentially, you want the top portion of the field to have 18 chances at birdies if they play it well, but also all those holds be hard enough that they could bogey them at the same time. That's disc
golf. Well, we also, yeah, and I think too, like obviously Paige, Haley, Kat, Kristen, there's a handful of girls that throw considerably further than everyone else.
Yes.
But you can look on the MPO side and see the same exact thing. There's a handful of guys that throw considerably further than everyone else. Holes are not created for those four or five people.
No.
They're not. And I don't think holes should be created for those four or five FPO people. Like, Paige, regardless of how far in advance the FPO side goes, Paige throws far for an FPO player.
Yes.
And so, you know, obviously we've talked about like the field depth and all that stuff on MPO. I don't think the MPO side isn't going that way. Well, kind of. D-Glo, we'll talk about that in a second. But like, we're not playing on a hole that's requires a 500 foot shot for you to birdie.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I don't know. That's my view on it. I thought it was obviously Paige. Gutty win.
It still was an entertaining win. You know, it still came down to the wire.
Never counting yourself out. Never counting yourself out and stuff. It's just, it's kind of what we talked about. Like, when you step up on a hole, you want to be able to have that birdie, par, bogey.
Yeah.
And a lot of the holes, the FPO were stepping up. A lot of the holes, it was like par or bogey.
Yeah.
So like the birdie was just like out. And so like you have such a small like kind of window.
Yeah.
So that's all I'll say about that. Obviously, I'm not going to speak for the FPO field on what they – this is just kind of from a pure spectator, a fan of disc golf. Like, I enjoy watching disc golf a lot more when you're seeing people challenged. You see the risk rewards. You see them having to think about what shots to do. And I just felt like a lot of the holes out there, everyone just played it the same way.
Yeah. For sure. So let's talk through D-Glo. I mean, what you've been hinting at the course a few times. Walk us through it. What's it been like? I know you just got one practice round in today, but
yeah, I got one practice round in. You know, a lot of the course is very much similar.
Mm-hmm.
But they have, I don't think they really changed. They didn't. I don't think if the hole it looks the same, it's the same. So they didn't really do much of changing that. They just like took some holes out and put brand new holes in.
Gotcha.
A couple of them I like, a couple of them I'm not a huge fan of. A lot of like 500 plus downhill par threes.
Interesting. So just using the elevation a lot.
I guess. I don't know how much I don't know if I like it. Yeah, well, I don't know if I like that.
What's the pro and con of it? Like what's the bad thing?
I mean, it's not Memorial, right? It's not like a 500 foot where you can just throw a hyzer at it. None of these holes you can throw hyzer at, but like, they're not really like shots you ever really practice.
Mm.
And it's like, not really I don't know if it's a shot you can really replicate multiple times.
I got you. So it's like asking the disc to do weird things.
Again, this is someone, you know, I can birdie every hole in this course. So it's not like I'm like, oh, this hole's too hard, I can't birdie it. I can birdie every hole in this course. There's going to be a lot of people that can't birdie a lot of these holes. And again, it kind of goes back to that whole thing we were talking about. Like, you step up to a hole, it's 555 feet. Granted, yeah, sure, it is downhill, but still, it's like, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what other people think. I obviously only went through it one time real quick. I think there was only like two holes like that though, but it was interesting to see that they did two holes that were like extremely long par threes, downhill.
Yeah.
They did change one of the par threes that was uphill into like a par four. And now it's like a really, really challenging par four. Love that. But yeah, I mean, it's an overall awesome course. And again, it's a really fun course to come back to. I did not get to play it last year. I believe, right? Yeah, I didn't get to play it last year. That's why. Okay, that makes a lot more sense. Because I was like, dang, I'm throwing some of these holes look like I'm throwing so much further on some of these holes. It's because I haven't played in 2 years, not 1 year.
Mm.
So that makes a lot more sense. But yeah, no, this course, I'll just say this course is way easier when you can throw far. way easier. But yeah, it's a fun one. It's one of the few that like really uses a lot of the elevation changes.
Mm-hmm.
And has some really cool greens. And yeah, it's a fun one. So,
nice.
But that's all I had on my end. Do we want to do a couple questions?
Well, yeah, Silas, as the questions roll in, pop a few questions in the live chat. We'll get those kind of wrap up the show. Heading into D-Glow, you mentioned you're back a few times. How's it feeling? You completely back to normal
good?
Or?
No, it's, I mean, I think the flight obviously jacked it up a little bit more, got a little bit tight as well.
Yeah.
Roll it out a little bit. It's getting a little, I mean, I threw forehands fine today, so that's always nice. But
did you do anything to get it progressively better during the European Open? Because you said round four was a lot better than round one. Was there like something you were doing, or is it just healing with time?
I think a little bit of time, and then obviously I was just rolling it. I was foam rolling it. I got like a pressure point ball that I was using, and then I just was up on some Advil and adrenaline, I think.
There you go. I'll do it. Advil, adrenaline. It's almost like
audio
adrenaline. Is
that 50th episode?
I think the number's right. I think, because the last live stream was 48. We had 1 week where we did the post-produce. That should have been 49.
49?
And this should be 50. I believe these are 50.
Ooh, 50. Yeah.
Wow. All right. Hey, hats off to us, guys. Let's go. 50. Let's go.
Any questions in the chat?
Brody, how close to max potential do you feel that you've gotten?
Oh, like how close am I into my ceiling?
Yeah, I guess that's what they're saying there.
It's a solid question.
I feel like I'm maybe like a 75%. I would say.
Do people ever know when they reach their ceiling? I don't think I've ever reached my ceiling in anything before.
No, you do. You do because you start going down. Mm. That's how you know. It's like, you don't know you've reached your ceiling until it's too late, basically.
I got you.
And then you're like, oh, man.
I think I've reached my life ceiling in disc golf, but I don't think I reached my talent ceiling, if that makes sense. Like, I don't think
that doesn't make sense.
I don't think I'll ever be as good at disc golf as I was in college. But I don't think I was as good at disc golf as I possibly could have been. Because I don't think I'll ever dedicate as much time as I did in college. But in college, I still had, like, I definitely could have been better at disc golf. But then I just haven't practiced as much. So that's what I'm saying. Is like, I think I technically I technically reached my disc golf ceiling. Like, I don't think I'll ever throw a disc better than I was in college. But I didn't reach
you
my.
You could though.
I could.
You could.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think there's two different things.
You don't know that.
Well, I know I'm not going to put as much time as I did in college.
Right.
I know that.
Right.
So then that's what I'm saying.
You could.
I could. I'd have to quit my job, but I could. You know what? Screw it.
That could be part of your job, though. You could do like a 6 series of like, I don't know, something where you practice 3 or 4 hours every day, and you know we film it and you know get content from it and see what happens.
If I'm ever motivated to do that,
well, see, that's the problem is the motivation.
Well, I don't have any. My drive in college, but I thought I was like, you know, maybe I'll try this touring thing out. And I also was playing for a major every year at college nationals. Now I don't have anything I'm playing for.
What if we did?
It'd be like,
what
if we maybe did I'll win that seat here
again. Foundation Weekly, man.
Well, I just got to beat Trevor.
But what if you did something of like, all right, this year I'm going to try to qualify for USCGC. And so like you
that's
did like
near
a
impossible.
You nope.
Oh, like you
how?
Do Monday
what?
Qualifying, you're saying?
Yeah, Monday qualifying. So like you do like a 6 month program. Of like, all right, I'm going to lay out all the stuff I'm going to do for 6 months to try to get as good as I possibly can. And we film it. We chronicle it. It's a full series. And then it ends with you trying to qualify. And we film it and see how you do.
We could make a documentary out of it.
I mean, that would be electric.
The Hunter Thomas.
And playing USCGC would be like a life dream of mine. Like, if I got to hear that guy, I got to, for the Dean's Cup, that dude announced my name. And it was like, insane. It was the coolest moment ever.
Hey, Robbie C said he'd join you for that.
Heck yeah, Robbie. There we go. Robbie C and Hunter, take it on.
What do you think you would need to, would you need coaching? Would you need to get someone to help you get there? Or do you think it's simple? Like, do you think you know what you need to do to get better? Like, you know what?
I think I would need a little coaching on distance. But I think that the big thing that I would need is consistency, which I think I could just do. The field work drills and stuff I've practiced before, because we played a course called Dunipace Dunes, and it was a very OB heavy course, and so I developed a lot of field work drills that worked very well for like getting my disc to land softly on certain angles and know exactly where it's going to be. And I feel like that we have also played the USDGC course several times, so I feel like I know the course very well and stuff. What I'm missing on the USDGC course is distance A and forehand distance. Is probably bigger than distance. I feel like there's a lot of shots I'm like, if I could just throw a forehand 200 feet farther right here. But like,
okay, that's
do you think you'll ever get to 1,000 rated?
Me?
Yeah.
No. My best shot was the COVID ratings. I got the 989. And that was my chance. I played a tournament. I did the math. If I would have averaged 10-15 at that tournament, I would have been 1,000 rated, and I was going to retire from disc golf forever. I was never going to play another tournament. I averaged like 9-10 at that tournament, and I dropped to where I am now. I had too much pressure on myself.
No, you could totally be 1,000 rated. Just don't play in anything for a year.
But that's essentially what the COVID ratings did. Is it? I just reset
my
ratings. Don't
play for a year while you're doing this journey. And then
I guess I technically could, because if I did this whole thing, A, and then I just cherry picked my events that are courses I know I'm going to play very well.
Just play Memorial. Boom. 1,000 raid.
Yeah. Now I'd play local tournaments. There's a few courses around here that I'm like, I'm never going to shoot really bad at, and I have a chance to shoot really good at. So I just play those courses every time a tournament's there, just over and over and over. I could probably do it. Maybe that'd be a fun thing of like trying to cheat the rating system.
That'd be a fun. I'd be all about helping that project.
Like if I found a way, I just took a year off of disc golf, like no tournaments for a year, which I'm pretty close to already being there. Year off of disc golf tournaments. And then when I came back, I just cherry picked like 4 or 5 events that got me the 8 rounds within the year that I needed. And
I'll also play in those events and purposely play bad.
There we go. Now we're talking. Have someone throw.
Yeah, I'll just. We'll get Silas in there. Have him shoot like a 400 rated round.
Yeah, I already do that.
We just set up a sanctioned league that only us are at.
Is that a thing? Yeah. I mean, surely that's a thing. Surely people are doing that.
You can do a sanctioned league.
Is that like a...
I'm sure it's against the PDJ code of conduct, but if we just all made fake accounts for the name of science.
Man, it's for science.
I would be curious if like we really did that where like I played really good, Brody showed up, played really bad, and Silas also played really bad. We had like everyone else threw, but me.
Yeah.
But like they threw proportionally. So like Brody threw kinda, Trevor threw kinda, Silas threw kinda, and then I just play out of my mind and beat Brody.
And you're like 1060?
Yeah, I'm like 1060. I become the highest rated player in the world.
Why hasn't someone already tried that though?
Because I mean think of what I just said, all the work that would take.
Yeah, but I mean somebody's gotta be paying these people off or something like that.
I mean that would require so much work.
I'll give you $4,000 if I'm the highest rated player in the world.
Well, I'm not paying someone off. I would get the rating system. I would just abuse it.
You could just pay a bunch of people off.
Well, yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, I could probably pay someone and get a rating.
Hunter's life doesn't change at all if he becomes 1060 rated this way. He gets maybe some like more like publicity and stuff.
But then I roll up to one event and I lose it all.
Just play no more.
Do you think we could do this with someone like undercover? Because we couldn't do it obviously with you. But like we just handpick someone, we're like, hey, we're gonna get you 1060 rated and then see if we can get him like a sponsorship. Like a big sponsorship.
Oh. Well, I remember Jackie Chen. There was a... What tournament was it? He showed up at some tournament.
What happened to that guy?
Balled out of his mind. He beat... I think Paul was there. James Conner was definitely there. Maybe Paul wasn't there. He beat several notable players. Was like 1040-something rated. But it was his only event. He just showed up, balled out, 1040-some rated. Everyone's hyping him up, right? End of a sponsored. He's just getting hyped out. And then he comes over here, plays Vegas, and just got destroyed. And it was like, oh, he just had a really hot weekend. But it was like his only ratings. He was like mid-1040 rated. Like he was one of the highest players in the world. But then he came over and played with all the highest players in the world and was like, oh, yeah.
So just go to some country that doesn't have disc golf.
No, because the whole reason was he beat James Conrad and like two other players that were there. You got to beat high-rated players.
Yeah.
That's the key.
That's not the key.
That is
the
key.
The key is to have low. It's more important to have low-rated people that blow up.
Well, yeah, high-rated. That's why the OB does so good at Memorial.
Did you see the change in ratings from round 3 to round 4?
No, I didn't. I didn't see it.
Yeah, so look that up real quick.
It's probably easier for me to look it up.
Wow.
Silas is monitoring the chat. I think he could do it.
Silas hasn't even said one of the questions from chat.
Are you kidding me? Yeah,
I have. Silas hasn't given us one question from chat.
Oh, my word. Dropped 18 points round 3 to round 4.
Oh, I wonder what happened. What happened? What was the difference there?
It rained round 3, man.
There was a cut?
No, rain. It rained round 3, dude. Don't question the system.
The rain. Oh, you just cut all the people that made the course look way harder than it was.
Never question the system, man. Yeah, it dropped. It dropped very considerably round 4. Because even you go round 2, which there wasn't rain, Chandler Kramer shot a 53, 1071 rated. Eagle shoots a 53 round 4, 1058. 13 points.
So
the course is playing a stroke and a half easier, is what it was round 4.
Well, yeah, clearly.
Brody, what's your favorite course on tour?
Well, it's tough to say because I feel like it's going to be probably maybe one of the GMC courses that I haven't played yet.
Okay, we'll just say right now
that you've played.
I really like Idlewild. I really like playing Idlewild a lot. And Des Moines probably is the other one.
Do you think being tall helps you as a disc golfer?
Absolutely does. No matter what he says, answer?
Brody, I asked Brody.
Okay, good. Well, being a lot of times tall guys are like, oh no, but Brody said it does. So
I would say it's not as important as in other sports, though. It helps, but it doesn't help as much as it does in other sports.
That's fair. I think wingspan's bigger than height in disc golf.
Well, the taller you are, the better wingspan.
True, but ape index is a thing where you can be short with long arms.
Guys, ask Mark's question. I'll answer that.
What?
Look at Mark Myers.
If anything from MPO gets screwed on ratings, why is the best?
No, restart that sentence. Restart the sentence.
If anything the FPO gets screwed on ratings, why is this the best MPO 1050 and the best FPO 950-ish?
Literally look at the tournament we just played.
Boom.
Is the easiest way of explaining that.
Oh, here we go from Robbie. How far is considered far on tour versus amateurs in their opinion?
What does that mean? How far is it?
I'll answer how far I think is far, and you answer how far you think is far.
Like if you I'll just ask y'all both the same question.
Yeah.
If I say that dude throws far, how far do you think that person throws?
450.
Oh.
And then Brody.
We're talking about not like an open field trying to throw as far as you can, like an actual shot.
Actual shot. Like you're, well, Silas, what are you talking? You're talking like golf shot, or are you talking flex out 450?
I'm just talking
like he's throwing for distance.
Regular shot.
It's a regular shot. So on the course, someone steps up a 450-foot hole, parks, you're like, wow, he throws far.
Yes.
Okay. So golf shot. How far is far?
Probably like 475.
So about the same.
Very close.
Not the same.
Okay.
I would say very few
people throw 500 feet.
I would say if you went lower level amateur, Silas has played with Brody and Trevor and I and several other players that throw over 400 consistently. I think that if you ask an average player, 400 would be far. Like 400 is far. Even for me, like,
yeah,
I'm getting 450 if I'm like pumping, but if I'm on a course and if it says 400, I'm like, I think I can get there. If it says over 400, I'm like, this is gonna be a pump.
Yeah,
but so I think a normal person would say 400. I think tour 475.
Yeah,
makes sense.
Well, because like 400, the people that throw far were throwing mids at that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm throwing my hex 350 nowadays. Apparently,
yeah, dude,
so
you bomb that thing.
I don't know what it's just the hex. It's
You're
incredible.
Bombing. It's gyro.
It's gyro. Goes farther.
Those meteors go really far. Those crystal meteors.
We still have some in the
so
shop.
So much fly.
If you live near
so
Lynchburg.
So much fly.
I haven't thrown them.
So much fly.
I think the hex and the meteor seem like a very similar disc. My theory on gyro, after my month, not to spoil everything about the video that hasn't come out yet, but I think what it is gyro has some molds that go very far. I don't think gyro is what is making those molds go far. Because I think the hex flies very similar to a really good run of meteors.
So you think it's the mold and not the science?
I think it's a lot more the mold than the science. I think.
So if I had 20 hexes and 20 meteors and I threw them and we took the outliers out, we took out the top five in each, we took out the bottom five in each, and we just counted the middle 10, you think they're about the same?
I think they'd be about the same, I think. Because I've thrown some meteors that I'm like, holy cow, that thing goes far. I think what it is just that perfect amount of flip in a mid where it doesn't flip all the way over and like cut out on you, but it has enough
where
you throw it on
hyzer.
Yeah, you throw it on hyzer and it wants to pop up and go. That in a mid is what gets it out far. And the hex does it very well, and a good run of meteor does it. I've had some meteors that flip on me a lot more than others. And I've only thrown like three hexes, so there could be hexes that do the same thing, but the hexes I've thrown have all flipped up to flat and went, and I think that it's this very similar to a good run of meteor. So I think I'm not going to say completely that gyro doesn't go farther, because I definitely, some of my farther throws have been with gyro discs, but I think a lot of it is the mold. I think they have a few very, very solid molds that make people think this craft going farther. We do need the robot.
That would be sick.
We do need a robot.
Wasn't what's his name, David Wiggins, at some like golf thing getting his form analyzed or something?
Oh, he did have
like,
he has a swing
coach.
That's
cool.
He has a swing coach.
The future of disc golf.
And he also did have like a they did like a 3D motion tracking thing.
Yeah. Like, that's cool.
But he was one of the first players I heard that I'm pretty sure it was a golf swing coach that's picked up disc golf and is like a disc golf swing coach. And David Wiggins was saying that he has a swing coach. Apparently developed a whole workout plan specifically. He told Trevor on the Trevor Staub show specifically for breaking the distance record.
No, Trevor said that he should do that.
No, he did do it.
Oh, he did?
Trevor said he should release it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Gotcha. I mean, I'm buying it.
Yeah. I'd buy that. The world record distance holder, you know, workout program on how to throw far. Like, I don't care if it works or not. I'm buying that. 10 times out of 10.
You guys are probably also the people that bought those shoes where this made you walk on your toes the whole time to jump.
Heck yeah, I owned those. Did I ever dunk? No, I touched rim once, though. I would jump rope in them every day. I wanted to dunk a basketball so bad, and I had no athletic ability to jump.
What does it feel like to never have dunked a basketball?
Bad.
What is
very
that
bad.
Feeling?
I mean, I've dunked on like 9 foot was the best I could ever do.
No, a legitimate dunk. How does it feel to never have dunked?
Awful.
I've never
Awful.
Dunked.
You could dunk, Silas. If you trained for...
If I trained, probably.
If you tried for like... You have the height.
I can get rim right now.
I think right now I could get like the top part of the net. Like that last V on the net. I think that's where I'd be at. Like where the net comes down into a V there, I think that's where I'm at right now.
I remember.
I tried. We were up by a lot.
Dunking on someone might be like a top 10 feeling in the world.
I'm sure it would be. I was always envious. I tried one point in high school. Was obviously when I could jump the highest because I was trying hard to jump high. Just could never do it.
You could jump the highest in high school?
Well, once I got to college, I only played disc golf, so I just never jumped.
Oh,
when's the highest you could jump
ceiling.
In college?
You missed your ceiling, man.
I'm sure
yeah,
I did.
Yeah, like
that
probably when
ceiling?
I was like, probably when I was like 22.
Yeah, because I never played basketball in college. I mean, I played a few pickup games and stuff, but like I wasn't
23, 24, like yeah. Right, like.
So maybe if I started training
been,
right
like,
now,
honestly, like,
I'm 25 right now. I just turned 25.
I don't know, man.
I'm in my athletic prime. This is my time to freaking dunk.
Yeah.
That's a Foundation Nation series. Hunter gets to dunk. I got to shed about 20 pounds.
Well, I don't think it's going to happen.
25?
Hunter dunks on
athletic
Brody.
Prime? When is the athletic prime?
You just haven't done anything really athletic, though, like that.
I have never dunked.
No, I know, but I'm saying, like, you switching to disc golf, like, that hurts you. Because,
it definitely
like,
hurts.
You're not really... You're not really doing any of the explosive, like, vertical movements at disc golf.
Peak in their mid-20s. Exactly where I'm at.
There you go.
I can do this.
But you're almost past it.
Endurance sports peak in their 40s. Heck yeah. So I'm going to be running marathons in my 40s.
I get like
is that your goal?
27, 28,
no.
You should be good. 27, 28, you should be good. Like to still be very athletic.
So if I start training now, maybe I'll be I would love to go to my be able to be like 35 and look at Luca in the eyes and be like, yeah, I dunked a basketball.
Rocco said 28 to 32 is their prime.
All right, so I got 3 years to enter my prime.
It's actually kind of sad that you haven't dunked a basketball. Like
I'm 5'10". Who am I? Nate Robinson?
Okay,
you think I'm just like jumping
enough.
Up like no, I'm
fair
5'10".
Enough, fair enough, fair enough.
I'm a 5'10" shooter. What am I supposed to do?
I was thinking you're a 6 foot. Fair
my
enough.
My job was to park
say,
on the perimeter. And
hey,
shoot.
Here's your inspiration. Rocco said he's 5'10" and he got dunk. He got to dunky a softball at age 26. That's your inspiration.
He never got to
man.
A basketball though. That
hey,
doesn't help me.
Softball bat.
Well,
same,
he might
thing.
Have small hands.
Same thing.
Same thing. He might have small hands.
I can palm a basketball, so I got that
you
going
can?
For me. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's surprising.
The frick, dude.
A lot of people can't palm basketball, Silas.
I can one. I can palm.
I know. I'm saying it's surprising you can.
Oh. No, he probably has like that weird like where he's like
my thumb goes down.
Finger can go really, yeah.
Look at that
see,
spread.
He's got that.
Look at that spread, baby.
Yeah.
Look at that spread.
He's got the weird webbing thing.
Yeah, man. What? Look how far down my thumb can go.
My thumb can go down far too.
That's what makes it where I can palm, right, without having
your
big hands.
Your thumb placement?
Yeah. My thumb and middle finger.
Being able to have your thumb, being able to have your thumb and pinky like wider.
Yeah. I don't think you have to be able to palm a basketball.
You don't
to
have
dunk.
To. It makes life easier.
You can just kind of like just have it resting on your arm or your hand. Sorry.
Yeah, but it makes life a lot easier.
I'll allow a self alley-oop dunk as well, Hunter. Like, I'll allow that because that's probably the only way.
I got to break out the jump rope, man.
Yeah, it's your time.
My time.
Your time.
My
is
dad.
Now.
My dad was able to dunk a basketball, and he's got 2 inches on me.
Oh, dude! Get
so
wrecked.
It's in my blood. I can do it. I can't do it, man.
All right, couple more questions, and we out of here.
Oh, what I was gonna say though is one of my good friends got those jump shoes, which is why I bought them, because he got them in 8th grade, and in 10th grade. He was jumping out of the gym dunking. He would wear them to school every day in 8th grade. he had the actual shoes, so he wore them to school every day in like 8th and 9th grade.
And just, was he potentially just an athletic person that finally hit his growth spurt?
He was very athletic. No, he never hit a growth spurt. It was Logan. Logan never hit a growth spurt.
Oh, really?
He's like 5'9". Yeah, he could dunk.
Yeah, he's not that tall.
Oh, he could jump out the gym. Yeah. He never liked basketball. Wow. He just did it to flex. That was his whole goal. Is he wanted to be able to dunk just to flex on people.
That's funny.
Sure, he flexed on you, man.
He did. I got dunked on in PE class once.
Okay. What is my...
You think he's going to Siri? I got dunked on in PE class, and it was very embarrassing. I got dunked on in a few basketball games, too,
you
obviously.
You got dunked on, dude?
Multiple times I've been dunked on.
That's embarrassing.
Yeah.
You gotta take the charge, man.
I was a big charge guy.
Yeah.
I was a big charge guy.
I respect
guy.
That.
I was freshman.
That's why you like to
my freshman year, I was on varsity. I was just a practice guy on varsity, but I got to ride the bench. But the senior, his name was Matt, they like hazed me, I guess you could say. They set me up in the layup line. We were like doing the typical layup line where you got under the basket for the rebound. And so I like jogged in for the rebound and I like was like where the heck I think Ryan was supposed to go next. I like turn around, he's not there, and then he like passed the ball and I turn around and it's just Matt midair just dunking on me. And like that was my first experience varsity basketball. I was like, dang, I just got dunked on. Everyone and the coach laughed at me. It was brutal. But hey, you know?
Well, at least it wasn't in game.
Oh, I got dunked on bad in game. We played this public school about 2 hours away. What was their name? It was just outside Richmond. And we rolled up and our best player, one of our best players had just got expelled. Our second best player, just like he was fine all day, decided he had strep throat out of the blue. When whether or not he was sick is still to be determined.
Sounds like you're making a lot of excuses already.
Well, no. So like we roll in and next thing you know, we lost our point guard and our starting shooting guard. So we're starting two bench players. And then we had to start, we didn't have, our backup point guard wasn't great. So it was just a whole slew. I was a shooting guard.
Oh.
I guess the other guy was technically small forward. But
you wouldn't know that from the basketball video that we did.
No, I wouldn't. You're right.
All right. Anyways, so I had to guard their best player and it did not go my way. And anyways, I was sprinting back on defense and I find my man. And he's like bringing the ball up, but I'm like, it's like a 3-on-2, whatever break. So I'm in the paint and he gets like to the white line and threw a pass. And the other teammate picked him up. So I react and drop into the paint and he just lobs it up. And I just turn and just face full of crotch, dunked on so hard. It was like their gym was packed. The student section went crazy. I was like, I need to be subbed out of this game right now. That was brutal. It was an alley-oop just straight on my face. It sucked. It sucked. It wasn't I didn't have time to like react at all. I just turned and I'm just getting absolutely hammered. It was
I'm
awful.
Trying to think what I would give up, what I would do to guarantee that my first son. Well, I guess that happened to my first son, but guarantee that I have a son that is like good at basketball. like what I would give up or what I would do for that. I think I would do a lot. I might kill someone, Silas.
Whoa.
Because, like, just imagine going to, like, the high school games and just seeing your son just absolutely dominate.
Did,
like,
you, yeah. Did you play basketball?
That's why I wanted our – Liz is watching.
I did
until – she knows.
I did until everyone got their growth spurts, and I didn't.
I wanted our son's name to be Cannon. Bad.
Cannon?
Think how sick that'd be in a starting
lineup.
Like
the legacy Cannon?
Not like the legacy
Cannon.
Cannon
Thomas?
Last name needed some work. You know, we'd have a nickname or something, but Cannon.
Cannon T.
That's such a, like, that's such a baller name.
Cannon?
Yeah.
I like Luka better.
Well, Luka Doncic. I'm hoping Luka Doncic wins a few like championships or something.
I don't know.
I'm trying to think what would have been a funny name with Thomas as the last name.
I also pushed hard for Cameron. I think the middle name we liked was Blake, but mainly because Cameron Indoor Stadium. I wanted something tied to Duke. I wanted to be able to call my son JJ really bad, but my wife hated that. So anything I suggested that she knew, I'd call him JJ. His middle name's James. He's Luka James, so I think I can still pull it off. There's
JT.
A J in there.
JT.
No, he only has one J.
So you call him JJ from the beginning. Who cares?
That's true.
Oh, maybe Tommy. You should have gone with Tommy.
Tommy Thomas? That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right. JJ Redick. JJ Redick only has one J. I had to look up his middle name because I thought he did. Yeah,
hey,
he's just Jonathan Clutt.
Liz said it's not too late to change it.
No, I like Luka James.
Two more questions and then we're out of here.
I gotta get food. I haven't eaten yet. I'm a hungry boy.
When will caddies be required to carry a bag instead of walking around behind the ropes for no reason?
I mean,
yeah, please.
As soon as the PDGA gets some common sense.
Please, let's stop having people just walk with people. Like, we should not have emotional support people walking with us. If you're going to be a caddy, carry the bag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the
Kelsey was a caddy for me, and she tested it out one of the practice rounds. I said, "Can you do this?" And she's like, "Oh, yeah." I was like, "All right, sweet."
Nice. All right, one more here. Brody, do you mind being paired with Ezra in tournaments? From Griffin.
No, I don't care who I play with.
Was the vibe of the card in a Terry Miller
I
type
do
question?
Know the story that you the story that you told on Griplock, though. I was on that card.
What?
I know exactly who you're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
The seven iron guy.
Yeah. Hey, now he's on premise, dude. Yeah, I was walking with Brody's card on that thing.
I've played surprisingly when you aren't on coverage, you kind of see people's true colors a little bit more. So I've played with all sorts of people. One of the people that I played with this past tournament got really upset at one point on something, and they could like didn't let it go the whole hole and was like constantly. It's like you just learn to kind of just like focus on what you need to focus on. So, yeah, I don't care who I play with. I've played with all sorts of different people at this point, and it doesn't really bother me.
All right.
I just, yeah.
There you have it. That wraps up the show.
I need to play better. That's all. I just need to play better because I've been playing pretty bad. I need to play better.
That wraps up the show. Hopefully you enjoyed this week's debate night. And possibly the last week is called debate night. If you have any suggestions for other names, be sure to put them in the actual comments, not the live chat, the actual comments of this video, or tweet them at us at debate night pod, or you can tweet Brody or me and let us know what you think it should be. We'll brainstorm some ourselves as well. And you know what?
It's going to be wild.
Next Tuesday, there might be some new graphics and all of that. We'll still keep the same numbering system because we'll still use the same Buzzsprout or the thing that feeds you to to Spotify.
We're not going to start at number one. Just
no.
A brand new podcast.
No, I think I can update the name and everything, and it'll feed it to Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all of that. So we'll keep it 51 next week. But there you go. That's the podcast. Hopefully you enjoyed. We'll talk to you all next Tuesday. Check the mic and make sure.